Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording from our Tuesday evening Truth of Happiness Dhamma Study talk that explains the 12 causative links of dependent origination. This was recorded on January 31st, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So we started with meditation. The next week was the Four Foundations of Mindfulness to teach us primarily how to be present with what's occurring without reacting. We learned what the Four Noble Truths are, and we learned how we contribute to our own dukkha, and then we studied the Eightfold Path to develop that framework for recognizing where our contributions to our own suffering arises and how to get out of that. And now we've studied the environment in which all this is occurring in, an impermanent environment where a not self-characteristic arises, creating dukkha. Now, the next area of study is going to be dependent origination, and then the following week we're going to get into the five clinging aggregates. So if you notice the progression, now we kind of went from this gross overarching view of what's going on, and now we're more finely tuning our mindfulness as to what's really going on. When the Buddha passed, the last words he said is, impermanence and decay is relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. Now remember, there's nothing ambiguous about that because he spent his whole life teaching how to do that. He taught an eightfold path to developing awakening. And he's speaking directly to the most important aspect of impermanence. We never know what the next moment's going to be. We never know when the end is there for us. The most important thing in life, even the Dalai Lama, who practices something a little different than we do, not to put him down, said that the purpose of time is to awaken. The reason why we're here, the most important thing we can do is to awaken. Impermanence points to that, doesn't it? It points to it in an overarching way. We can do it, but also we never know what the next moment's going to bring. So that helps to fine-tune the Dhamma for ourselves. We got to take to it. Now, as we start dependent origination, studying dependent origination, notice how this is an explanation of how a self arises, or a not-self, I should say, and a misunderstanding of what constitutes a self. So this is what the Buddha awakened to. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination. He explained that in his very first teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And I know I've said this a few times, but in this context, there's no real way of knowing when he actually first taught dependent origination called Paticca-samuppada. My guesses are that it's probably at least 6 months into his teaching, and it could be maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years. And the reason why is there wasn't enough understanding of everything else to understand dependent origination. We've got there in 7 weeks, so we're ready for it. So.
John?
Yes?
I have a question, and I won't say it's a quick question. But, so if everything is bound by the effects of impermanence, then wouldn't enlightenment as well be affected by impermanence? And I think we brought it up, you know, some of us brought it up tonight, where you feel like you're getting there and you're making progress. And then you're presented with new information. So, you know, is there a point when you're in total equanimity and is it that moment that's considered enlightenment? And how is enlightenment then not affected by impermanence?
How, I didn't hear the last thing you said.
How is enlightenment not affected by impermanence?
Well, it's such a great question. And it also, it relates to week 9 and karma and rebirth, but I'll talk a little bit about it now and then it might become more clear.
It's just, you know, something I've been thinking about, and you don't have to, if you want to go into the teaching tonight, you can, but it's just something that, you know,
yeah,
we can address it.
No, I'll just briefly, the glimpses of full maturity, and I'd rather use the word awakening rather than enlightenment or full maturity. We all have those. We experience those. And we might even have days or weeks when we feel like we're settled and our minds are calm and we're seeing things clearly. And then something occurs and we feel like we're right back where we started from. Of course, we're not, because we've developed an understanding. We don't lose what we don't lose true knowledge. You know, that's part of being a noble truth. A good example of what happens when you're fully awakened is the example of the Buddha, the Tathagata. He awakened and he never fell back into that. He never fell back into wrong views again. But he, throughout his life, he experienced the results of having a human life during those last 45 years. And even his last 3 months were very unpleasant. He suffered a lot physically. But his mind didn't become distracted by that suffering. He understood the process. So I don't know if I'm completely addressing your question.
So you're still
being
affected by impermanence, by living in a phenomenal world.
Yes.
You're still being affected by that.
Yes.
But the knowledge that you have brings you a more skillful way of living through those opportunities and things that present themselves as impermanence that might otherwise create dukkha.
Exactly. Your mind remains at peace and at calm. Why? Because you have gained right view. You understand what's going on. But that does not mean that you're not still subject to worldly causes and conditions. So, in other words, this may be your evening of awakening. But if there's an earthquake tomorrow, you're going to feel it. You know, it doesn't... This again, even a fully mature human being is still a human being. We're still subject to the vagaries of life. This isn't a path of escaping being a human being. It's a way of developing full human maturity. I mean, we're fully engaged in our life as life occurs. And that's the reward. That's Buddhist nibbana. Imagine having an extended period of time. Forget about for the rest of your life. Living in the world with everything occurring, and you're no longer distracted by it. You're no longer thrown to the winds by an election or something like, or anything else that might happen. You're able to be fully present. And that, and again, you've another a way of defining full maturity or fully awakened human being is you understand a difference between approval and acceptance. And you learn that you don't have to approve everything that occurs, but you can accept everything that occurs. Why? Because it's occurred. It's utter common sense, except we get an ego getting into, well, that shouldn't have happened, and if this went, blah, 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 and you're just going down this long, distracting rat hole. But an awakening occurs for most people gradually. And I think you would say, Liz, and I think everybody in this room would say that we've had experiences where things happen that would have normally thrown us for a loop and we're able to be peaceful. That's a glimpse of what it's like to be an awakened human being. And it's important to recognize that. And another thing it's important to acknowledge for you, Liz, is it's important, sitting in this seat, I know that people are developing understanding from the questions that they're asking, because a question is framed properly. Mm-hmm. And that question was framed properly. You know, it shows that your mind is inclined towards what's next in awakening. Mm-hmm. We're turning our minds away from the confusion, delusion, and delusion of craving and clinging, and moving our minds towards, wow, what's it like when I let it all go? It's pretty damn nice. Yeah. It's the most meaningful way of living in the world. And why is that so important? Well, we're living in the world. This is where we are. This is where we're having this life. Going back to that little story I gave, the handful of leaves, the Buddha understood, and he did talk briefly about these other things, but very briefly. If we can gain an understanding of the entire creation of all of the universe, what difference does it make? I'm still here in Frenchtown on Tuesday night at 8:31. Really, what's most important is, what's my view of what's occurring right now? Am I seeking to establish a self-referential ego self in this moment? Or have I freed myself from all those boxes, from that burden, from that yoke? And can I be at peace in this moment? The teachings say, yes, you can, no matter what's occurring. Great question. It really got me going too, didn't it? So bringing that back to where all this starts from. It is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that all manner of suffering arises, and dependent origination describes the process from ignorance, how we create a self born in that ignorance, and what happens. Is that clear? And what happens is, through 12 observable causative links, suffering. So let me read you what that is. The Buddha's words from the Paticca-samuppada. And I'll just preface it, the sentence before that, which isn't part of the sutta, my writing. Each of these 12 links are required to cause the self to experience confusion, disappointment, sickness, old age, death, and rebirth, how the Buddha describes suffering. From ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications. Simplest word to use is fabrications or assumptions. And you all heard that thing about assume assumptions. From ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications, come assumptions. Notice that ignorance is the requisite condition that starts everything off. It starts this whole 12-link chain of dependencies. From ignorance as a requisite condition. It's required. Why is that important? Because if we gain true knowledge, there's no more ignorance. This is why the Eightfold Path is classified as a path of wisdom and heightened virtue and heightened concentration. Wisdom supplants ignorance. The Eightfold Path is a path of developing ignorance where there was once ignorant. Where there was, what did I just say? From fabrications, yeah, I don't know. It's past. From fabrications or from assumptions. So what the assumptions are, views of self that we assume to be a self, born in ignorance. From fabrications or assumptions, as a requisite condition, comes consciousness. Now this is consciousness with a small c. It's not this grand consciousness that we all like to think about, that we're all part of. Maybe we are, maybe we aren't, but that's not important. This is consciousness with a small c. It's ongoing thinking that is rooted in ignorance. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness, this ongoing deluded thinking. From that consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. Notice the progression. First there's ignorance, then there's assumptions about who we are and the world around us, then there's this ongoing that has set in place, this ongoing way of thinking that is rooted in ignorance that now, we're using to describe the self. Name and form in Pali, it's nama rupa. Name is simply the self-identification we're giving to form, name and form. Right? So I'm from that ignorant-based thinking, I'm now describing myself. From name and form, from nama rupa, as a requisite condition. So I first have to go through this process. My thinking is now rooted in ignorance, and I'm using that ignorance to describe a self. From that comes the sixth sense base. Now again, the Buddha's dependent origination is often used to just as a creation story, and you'll see there's nothing at all in this that would be a creation story. I don't even know how that misunderstanding could have evolved. But the Buddha's not even talking about giving birth to a physical body. He's describing the condition that's already present. Is that clear? And the reason why that's important is that there's an underlying understanding that precludes all of this. Ignorance has set in. Ignorance is the requisite condition, but it's not a required position for us in life. It's only a required position for ongoing confusion, delusion, and suffering. It's only a required position for the establishment of anatta, that which the Buddha says, that's not a self, let go of the views. Am I clear about that?
So in that, ignorance as a requisite condition generates this nama-rupa, this name and form, which is essentially this, and then in turn a mechanism of interpretation that is this sixth sense base.
Yes.
That is now making a distinction as to self and other, or separating
yes
this and anything else out here.
It's the beginning of self-referential views, and we're using the sixth sense basis, our five physical senses, and that sixth sense of consciousness. And so now we're coming into contact with the world, and I'm using my sixth sense base to say this is me and that's you. That's the beginning of self-referential views. Now remember, we do, an awakened human being does exactly the same thing, but it's rooted in wisdom. We understand what's going on. Now we're talking about the problem of a self-evolving, maybe devolving is a better word, from ignorance, from that initial ignorance. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes context. Now, this that's because these are seemingly abstract ideas, they're only abstract because we haven't experienced it yet, it's hard to grasp. But look at that one sentence. From contact as a requisite, from the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. Of course, we have to have a sensory base in order to have contact with anything, don't we? I can't feel that if I don't have feeling as one of my senses. I can't smell a rose unless I have the sense, the scent, the sense of the scent. I'm going to leave it right there because I don't want to get too lost in those details. But just to make that point, that this is how we contact with the world. It's just an obvious statement. If I didn't have my senses about me, there'd be no contact. There'd be nothing going on. So the Buddha's not saying, and the teachings aren't saying, that the sixth sense base is something bad to have. It's because of the ignorance that we're now using something which is inherently purely functional. Now we're using it to create confusion, delusion, and suffering because our thinking is rooted in ignorance. Am I taking this progression? Are you following me in it?
I've never heard you say this so clearly.
Yeah.
You're rolling.
Oh, now the pressure's on. What am I going to do about that? Thank you.
So in other words, this is what we filter life's issues through as they go through our bodies, minds, and senses in terms of being a human being living in this world, and how we handle the filtering of that is the crux of the matter.
Yes, and because our view is rooted in ignorance, temporarily, remember impermanence, everything that follows from that can only reaffirm ignorance. An important aspect of ignorance is, in order to continue ignorance, we must, meaning the anatta, must ignore reality. And that's an ongoing stress-inducing situation. We must ignore what's really going on in order to continue to establish an ego self. That's the crux of the problem. And if you notice how, I don't want to get off track with that, but I want to come back to it. Helen, you had a question or comment?
I was just going to say, through the senses and consciousness, it's how we register everything around us, and what we do with that information depends upon the depth of our wisdom.
Or the depth of our assumptions, mm-hmm. our fabrications, because that's going to drive us. So I will touch on that. So we have developed certain assumptions, certain fabrications in our mind that we use to define ourselves. Anything from that point on that comes in that would challenge that view, mm-hmm. we'll just simply ignore it. No matter what it is, we will ignore it. And
again, depending on our wisdom. I've just been thinking tonight, I don't think I think about myself all the time, but I realized tonight that in most of my learning situations, I usually catch on pretty quickly, like I'm not in the back of the room. I beg your pardon? Nothing wrong with being in the back of the room. I didn't know there was a hierarchy here. but I sometimes feel like the things that I speak about in here are very elemental, which then makes me, that then makes me think about how I'm not catching on like I usually do. So I guess I do still have to work on it. I didn't think I was I really don't focus, I don't think, on myself. But now I'm seeing that I did have a certain idea about how I learn. And now it's sort of being shattered.
Uh-oh.
Not shattered, but...
The view... Well, yeah, first you're seeing that self-created veil, and now you're dropping the veil. And again, from your questions and comments, it's obvious that you have developed the framework of the Eightfold Path in order to see things clearly. Or you wouldn't even have recognized that. It's such an important thing to acknowledge. You know, that again, that's how we develop right view. So thank you for saying it. Sorry to shatter your... From contact as a requisite, let me go back to that one. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. From that contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. It's so obvious, isn't it? If you look at the progression. Now also remember, this is not a creation story. And in fact, these first links in this 12-link causative chain happen almost out of time. So we can get hung up with trying to look at a literal timely progression through this. This is something that occurs, and it has to be put into words that we as human beings can understand. But isn't it obvious that we have to have a self-referential view of our sixth sense base to create something over a feeling? I like it, I don't like it, or I'm indifferent to it. We have to have contact. It's just obvious. Why is it so important to understand this, something that is so obvious? Is because we miss it, because we're not well concentrated and we don't have the proper framework. We don't actually see this occurring. Let me continue. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. Before I had that first piece of chocolate cake, I never even thought about chocolate cake, but now that I had it, I can't get enough of it. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. And we do that with everything. And of course, that's feeling in a general sense. Feeling meaning everything that we're fabricating now. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. Take it back to the beginning. That feeling and my response or reaction to that feeling is rooted in an ignorant view. And here I am creating desire over an ignorant view. What can follow from that?
Suffering.
Only suffering. We haven't even gotten there yet, though. Boy, this is a heavy... class tonight, isn't it? It's not meant to be, because there's a way out. That's the best thing.
I got a box on my...
remember, there's a way out. From craving as a requisite condition, it's required. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. I got to keep that chocolate cake away from everybody else and not give it to anybody. I'm going to maintain that, because it solves all my problems and makes me happy. What an ignorant view, isn't it? It's even silly to think that way, but we do it with all kinds of different aspects of chocolate cake. If I can just hold on to this and keep recreating it into my life and keep this as my identity, if I can just cling to this, and this could relate to next week's class too, if I can just hold on to it, if I can cling my identity to, I am the person that has all the chocolate cake. No one can beat me. I'm the whiz. I love that old commercial.
Am I correct in seeing that craving always moves to the future and clinging is something that points to the past?
That's a good way of looking at it. Craving is the self-referential ego self requires, and suffering requires ongoing craving. So, of course, you can say, well, you can't crave for something you already have, but you can cling to it. And there's the instigation of discursive thinking, isn't it? And you're never satisfied. As soon as you cling yourself to anything, and now ultimately what we're looking at is clinging ourselves to self-referential views, not chocolate cake. I'm just using that as an example. And again, the 12 to 5 clinging aggregates are a description of clinging to views, rooted in craving. The ultimate craving is craving for a self-referential existence. And that, you heard me say, that's why the anatta, the ego, the self-referential ego self, must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs to it. Everything has an aspect of anatta until we have a framework to recognize it and we can start undoing this. Let me continue.
You can tell somebody, you can tell yourself, you can tell somebody they're okay, and you can tell yourself you're okay, but it doesn't make any difference if they don't believe it, if they don't know it, if I don't believe it, if I don't know it. And I was thinking about equanimity. If there's anything that I think love means, it's equanimity. Does that make any sense?
Well, sure it does. I mean, pure love has no self in it, does it?
No.
And that's the mind of equanimity.
Yeah, and that's what I think is is indescribable, I guess. It's what you experience.
It has to be. I mean, you can use words to describe equanimity, you know. Again, but that's what the Buddha meant when he kept using that word ehipasika. You have to experience this to know it. But here's how you... He didn't just say that and leave everybody alone. Here's how you have the experience of it. Develop this path. You know, again, he taught a path for human beings to develop, not special beings or somebody that might be given special powers, for human beings, for schmoes like us. You know, that's why it's here. So, let me continue. I'll go back that one. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. Let me make a point here. We can, if any one of these links is recognized and abandoned or unraveled, the whole 12 causative link chain falls apart. It's another way of describing the awakening process. So from craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. If you can really understand that at its most profound level, you realize that it's craving for a self-referential ego self to be preserved that creates that clinging. And abandoning that one wrong view and wrong intention leads to awakening. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. What does that mean? Comes because this is where they start using Paticca Samuppada to mean that it's a creation myth. The Buddha's not talking about now I've craved long enough and I cling long enough, now I'm going to give birth to something. It comes becoming. Remember the context. We're becoming established in ignorance. From craving and clinging comes becoming, comes a profound experience of what it's like to live my life rooted in ignorance, comes becoming. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth, the next link in the chain. Again, the Buddha is not talking about physical birth. Everything that gets born into this world is not the result of ignorance. What is given birth to is an ignorant view of self in the world, an ignorant view of the three marks of existence. That's what we're giving birth to, from rooted in ignorance. Is that clear? And again, this relates to week 9 when we talk, or now week 10, when we start talking about karma and rebirth. The Buddha's not talking about a present birth or a future birth. It's what we're going to give birth to in the next moment. And again, that points back to this week's study on impermanence. What will we give birth to? If our minds are well concentrated and framed by the Eightfold Path, then we will give birth to a moment that is inclining ourselves towards awakening, towards enlightenment. And if not, if we're still rooted in ignorance, the only possible thing we can give birth to is another ignorant moment. That literally is a choice that we have in each and every moment of our life. And that points to what the Buddha said on his deathbed. Impermanence and decay is relentless. We have the opportunity right here, right now, in this room, to awaken. If we're human beings, we have that ability. What we're lacking is understanding, if we're not quite there yet. I think we're all pretty close. Another 5 or 10 minutes, we'll be there. From birth as a requisite condition, remember how the Buddha first described suffering. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. I'm going to leave it at that. So the Buddha started from ignorance. He took us through these 12 observable causative links. We can observe them in ourselves. And ends at his description of suffering. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths through 12 observable causative links comes all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering. Now, when you read this week, then the Buddha goes into how to unravel this. And he takes us through the Paticca-samuppada in reverse order. And that's rather fascinating, but it's almost 9 o'clock, so I won't get into it. And you'll read it, and we'll talk about it next week. As you're reading this, and if you want to read the whole chapter, you can, but the chapter is broken up between dependent origination and the 5 clinging aggregates. Relate this to what you've learned so far in the course. Relate it to impermanence, the not-self-characteristic and resulting dukkha, and relate it to the Four Noble Truths. And you'll understand that the Buddha is teaching in a very simple and direct way how we create all confusion, delusion, and suffering for ourselves. And that's the important point. It's not a creation myth. It's not the problem with the world, although it is. It's what's occurring within ourselves. And if we can recognize that, then we can undo it. One of the ways the Buddha described suffering and not self is that you don't have any control over it. How can it be a self if you don't have any control over it? But this we do have control over. We can awaken. We can take control, literally, of our own minds and our thoughts. We can take control of what's going to occur in the next moment. That doesn't mean worldly causes and conditions. It doesn't mean we can take control of the lottery balls when they fall. It means we can gain control of how we think and consequently how we feel moment by moment. We can then extract true meaning out of each moment of our life because we're present for it. We're not distracted and we're not lost in that ignorance. We're not ignoring our own life. Any questions about dependent origination and what you're about to study? So Lorna's right in one way. I'm much more descriptive tonight than I've ever been, I think, about dependent origination. Maybe not that much more. But the more I teach this, the more I see how important it is to understand this. And I'm not saying that you need to grasp every one of these links, but to understand the process, that the process of suffering is rooted in ignorance. That's really the most important thing to gain from this. And how do we end that? You know, we end it through the Eightfold Path. And how do we know it's possible? Because the Buddha and a lot of other people did it. And we're experiencing it. And that's the other remarkable thing. And one of the things that we're most fortunate about, and I hear it all the time from online students that listen to what goes on here, we're getting it. You know, it's working. We're applying this in a way that's meaningful. And we're reaping the benefits of it. So,
I found that one of the less confusing ways to deal with dependent origination is to grasp one pair and look at that and tease that apart. And that will, then you can leave the rest alone.
Yeah.
But one that really, that talks to you. For me, it's always been anything having to do with desire. So, the craving and the clinging, you get into that, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And once you get one, by the scruff of its neck and start really worrying it, then meaning comes up.
Oh, yeah.
It becomes much clearer. I find it just trying to get all 12 of them in my head, forget it. It's just, I can't.
Yeah, it is. It's too much. But you're right. Thank you for that. And be aware of that. You might find one thing that really, one of these links that jumps out at you. Look at it, you know. Try to apply it to your own life and where you're engaged in this process. Because in order to continue confusion, delusion, and suffering, we have to be actively engaged in this process. It's ongoing. And now remember, it's not something that progresses in a timely manner. You could really say that until that point of giving birth to the next moment, dependent origination occurs outside of time. I mean, that's almost a ridiculous thing to say, but it's not something that is linear in a timely way.
It's simultaneous, really, in a lot of ways.
It's simultaneous, yes.
It is time. But yes,
and but then you can say that it is time. We're creating our lives based on this. Will it be based on ignorance or will it be based on wisdom? When the Buddha woke up, that's what he saw. He realized that up until that point, for the first 36 years of his life, he was ignorant of reality.
Well, it really comes down to the Four Noble Truths, because if you conquer clinging, you don't have to worry about the others. You're done.
When the Buddha described an awakened human being, he said that they were released from clinging. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he used the word unburdened, talking about those boxes. That's an awakened human being. Again, there's nothing magical or mystical about it. Maybe some people will say, well, who even cares about that? Why would I go through all this just to get to the point where I'm not clinging anymore? As you understand what we're learning here, you realize that really is the problem. And next week, we'll get into the five clinging aggregates. When the Buddha gave that description of suffering, the last thing he said, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And the five clinging aggregates are basically what we do when we create a self and we start clinging to those views. So, any questions about this? It's a lot, isn't it? Don't be overwhelmed by it. You know, it's not something that you have to memorize, but it is something that is very useful to understand. You know, and then we'll put it into even more context next week with the five clinging aggregates. So let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. There was something I was going to say, but I don't remember what it was. Retreat. Everybody knows retreat's coming up. Hope you can all join us. Registration is up on the website. The only other change is the Saturday class starts at 8:30. We don't have a separate sit anymore. Starts at 8:30 with a 30-minute sit and then directly into class. So. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.